Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. And we're going to start, as we typically do, with an essay from this book that my family gave me, 80 Things to Do When You Turn 80. But do remember, you don't have to be 80 to do these things. Today's article is by Jenny Sienna Bivona. She has created Ageless Authors, a series of anthologies by writers and artists over the age of 65. You can look into it at agelessauthors.com. She also helps other authors by editing and producing their books for self-publication. Like everyone else, when I was a whole lot younger, I always looked at aging as the end. No more fun, no more adventures. I would go dobby in the head, wobbly in the knees, and other body parts would sink to new lows. Turns out, like on several other occasions in my life, I was wrong. Now that I'm in my 80s, I find that it's actually almost like being 6 again. Only this time, there's nobody bossing me around. And the even better news is that I'm finally free to be the creative person I have always been. In the past, I was just too busy to find the time for all of the fun, artistic, and rewarding ideas that were bubbling around in my head. Sadly, I pushed them aside for what I thought were the more pressing duties of the day. But what a difference it makes to follow our bliss. I'm absolutely convinced that we can learn new skills at any age, and I have some powerful evidence to back me up on that. Her name is Barbara Mott, and she is a shining example of the loving wife and mother. Her life and goals were all about her family. She did do an occasional bit of china painting and even a little oil painting or two for the walls of her home. But it was just a form of entertainment for those rare, unbusy hours now and then in her busy life. Then, about 9 years ago, when Barbara was 82, her beloved husband decided to write his memoir. He asked Barbara to take dictation for the book, since she used to be a secretary in the days before they were married. Well, how antiquated can you get? Everybody knows that nowadays you have to write a book on computer. So, she went to the local junior college and learned how to use one. Yep, just like that. She didn't say, "I'm too old." She didn't say, "I can't." She just did it. And she wasn't the only student in the computer class. I met her when the book was finished. She brought the manuscript to me to help get it self-published, because that's what I do. After we proudly held the printed memoir in our hands, I began my new campaign. I encouraged Barbara to do her memoir. She says, "I harassed, hounded, and begged her." After refusing more than several times, insisting that she had no story to tell, she finally caved in and began to write, and write, and write. Her book is about 106 pages longer than her husband Bill's book. That was about 6 years ago. Recently, we published Petals and Thorns, a collection of her essays, poetry, and 50-word, really short stories that are funny as all get out. Barbara will celebrate her 92nd birthday this year. Don't tell me you are too old to learn something new. Recent research has shown that the human brain never stops adding new synapses, the tiny little connecting bits of brain where we store what we learn. And the biggest reason we seem to be slow in remembering is because the file boxes of a long life are so full. It takes a bit of time to go through everything, to dig out the exact file you are looking for. And I can see you smiling and nodding at that. So remember these 3 points. 1. You are never done till you decide you are done. 2. You never stop learning. And 3. The heat is off. Now it's time to have fun. Now, speaking of the brain, let's go on to our Mayo Clinic magazine, Understanding Alzheimer's, Your Guide to Brain Health. And we're going to focus on the Your Guide to Brain Health part of this magazine. We have a sidebar article today called Treatable Causes of Cognitive Impairment. Cognitive impairment isn't always the result of dementia. Several causes of cognitive impairment can be treated or reversed. Here are some samples. Infection. Meningitis, for example, can cause confusion, impaired judgment, and memory loss. If it's caught early, meningitis can be cured. Reaction to medication. Some drugs may produce side effects that cause short-term problems with memory and focus. Metabolic or endocrine imbalances. Diseases of the thyroid, kidney, pancreas, and liver can upset the chemical balance of your blood, producing dementia. A brain tumor. A tumor that presses against the parts of the brain that control hormone levels may result in dementia symptoms. Subdural hematoma. Pooling of blood between the brain's surface and its outer coating can interfere with cognition. Substance abuse. Misuse of certain prescription medications may produce dementia symptoms. Street drugs, especially on high doses, can have a similar effect. Chronic alcoholism. Complications of chronic alcoholism, such as liver disease and not getting enough nutrients, especially thiamine, can lead to dementia. Nutritional deficiencies. Not getting enough nutrients, such as B vitamins, can cause dementia-like symptoms. Poisoning. Exposure to toxic solvents or fumes without protective equipment can damage brain cells. In time, this can lead to dementia. Autoimmune system issues. Sometimes memory and thinking problems can be a sign of a problem with the immune system. In these cases, treatment with steroids may improve the symptoms. Now let's look at some causes. There's no single cause of mild cognitive impairment. It's a set of symptoms with many underlying causes grouped into several categories. Neurodegenerative. The term neurodegenerative describes destruction of nerve cells, neurons, in the brain that generally worsen over time. Alzheimer's disease is an example. Mild cognitive impairment can be an early warning of Alzheimer's disease. Vascular impairment results from conditions that affect the brain's blood vessels. Blood supply is limited, which causes cell damage and death and affects cognition. Sleep disturbances. Not getting enough good quality sleep can sometimes affect cognitive skills, including how well someone thinks and learns. Inadequate sleep may be due to insomnia, sleep apnea, or other sleep-related problems. Psychiatric. This category includes conditions that affect memory, concentration, and mood. Sometimes cognitive impairment is associated with a psychiatric disorder. Medications. Several drugs can produce side effects that impact brain function. In general, anytime someone experiences cognitive changes after starting a new medication, the drug's effects may be to blame. Examples include pain-relieving opioids and any drug that alters brain function, such as medications used to treat anxiety. Metabolic disturbances. Metabolism includes all of the processes the body needs to maintain life. A disruption to one or more of these processes can cause mild cognitive issues. Thyroid disease and not getting enough vitamin B12 are examples of disorders that can affect metabolism. Some causes of mild cognitive impairment can be reversed. That's why it's important to see a doctor when changes in cognitive function become noticeable. Making a diagnosis. It can be difficult to diagnose mild cognitive impairment. That's because memory issues vary from person to person, and people with memory issues often don't realize they're having problems. Often, forgetfulness becomes a concern when a new pattern emerges, such as asking the same question over and over, or having troubles keeping track of dates and names that once were easy to remember. Forgetting an appointment on occasion is fairly normal, but regularly forgetting specific events or activities may be signs of a serious underlying condition. There is no specific test to confirm a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment. Your doctor will decide whether mild cognitive impairment is the most likely cause of your symptoms based on the information that you provide and results of various tests that can help clarify the diagnosis. During an exam, you will likely be asked several questions, and you may be asked to perform some specific tasks, such as following a list of basic instructions. Certain tests can help show if a person's memory and other cognitive functions are impaired. The results of these tests are compared to other people in the same age group. Performing the same series of tests over time is often the best, as they capture the signs of decline. The criteria doctors use to diagnose mild cognitive impairment include the following: evidence of a cognitive decline when compared to previous tests and exams. This often involves memory loss, but may also include trouble with focus, decision-making, language, and visuospatial, motor, or social skills. It's best for these issues to be confirmed by family or friends or through testing. Being able to complete the activities of daily living. These include household tasks, taking medications, work responsibilities, and social functions. The presence of symptoms that aren't the result of delirium or another mental health disorder, such as depression. The symptoms that aren't severe enough to meet the criteria for dementia. Even with these criteria, a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment partly depends on a doctor's judgment within the context of each person's case. In general, an experienced doctor will combine information gained from personal interviews, a medical history, and test results to identify and measure cognitive change when making a diagnosis. Okay, moving on to AARP, the magazine, and a bit of exercise. Shake up your hips. Protect yourself from pain and disability with this preventative program. Modern life provides a perfect recipe for hip replacement. Because daily activities can involve spending much of our time locked into a G shape, knees bent, butt on a chair, upper body hunched over a desk or steering column, most of us develop tightness and weakness in our hips and surrounding muscles, resulting in hip, back, and knee pain. There's even a name for this phenomenon: dormant butt syndrome. Seriously, look it up. As a result, you probably know someone who's had a hip joint replacement, or maybe this procedure has been recommended for you. Fortunately, there's a way to fight back. Strength and flexibility exercises can help absorb shock and protect your hip joints from painful movements and further damage. A small 2017 study of women with osteoarthritis of the hip found that after 12 weeks of exercise, pain declined by 30%. Another study showed that hip strengthening exercises can cut the need for hip replacement surgery by 44%. Stronger hips can also help protect against falls and pelvic fractures and reduce back and knee pain. As a yoga instructor and therapist, I make improving hip strength and flexibility one of the primary goals for my patients. Here is the program I use to help them beat pain and, with luck, avoid further injury and surgery. If you've already had a hip replacement, these exercises may play a role in helping to support the new joints, especially by strengthening and moving the surrounding muscles, but be sure to check with your doctor first. This is a hips sequence for home. Before you begin this home routine, start with some belly breathing. Try to keep this pattern of relaxed breathing throughout the routine. So you're laying on your back, and you place one hand on your chest and the other on your abdomen. You put a small pillow or folded blanket under your head if you have tension in your neck, or if your chin tilts upward. Place a large pillow under your knees if your back is uncomfortable. Your hand position helps you detect motion during belly breathing. You can also just bend your knees and put your feet flat on the floor. 2. Inhale slowly and deeply, expanding your abdomen. Then pause for a few seconds. Exhale slowly, contracting your abdomen. Again, pause for a few seconds. Keep your chest and throat as relaxed as possible. Take 10 to 15 breaths. And here's a little item about chair yoga. Getting up and down off the floor, as in traditional yoga, can be challenging. Try these chair exercises, which will target all the necessary muscles and tendons that support your hips. Here we go. Seated pigeon. Sit tall in your chair. Exhale, bringing your bent right knee directly up. Hold the outside of that knee with your right hand and the outside of your right heel with your left hand. Place the outside of your right ankle on top of your left thigh, just above your knee. Drop your right knee toward the floor as far as is comfortable, but not below the other knee. Hold for 4 to 6 breaths. Repeat on the other side. You can slowly, gently, move your top knee up and down a few times to limber up the hip joint before you relax and breathe. Don't attempt this posture if you've had a hip replacement. Instead, try a gentler modification, such as extending both of your legs straight out with your heels on the floor. Cross your right ankle over your left. Hold for 4 to 6 breaths, then repeat on your left ankle on top. A seated forward bend. Sit facing forward on an armless chair, keeping your feet on the floor. Exhale as you slowly bend forward from your hips. Slide your hands down your legs. Let your head, chest, and arms hang comfortably. Stay in this position 4 to 6 breaths. Inhale as you slowly roll your body back up to the sitting position, straightening your torso, then pulling back your shoulders, and finally raising your head. There's a seated twist. Sit sideways in an armless chair with your right side toward the back of the chair. Twist your upper body gently to the right, holding the back of the chair with both hands. Inhale as you lift your spine and head upward, as though the top of your head were being pulled toward the ceiling. Hold this position as you exhale and twist your head and body further to the right. Stay in this twist for 4 to 6 breaths. Gently repeat steps 2 and 3, extending your spine even more and twisting farther to the right. Then return to the starting position. Shift your chair so you face the opposite direction and your left side is toward the back of the chair, and then gently twist, holding the back of the chair with both hands, and repeat steps 2 through 4, twisting to the left. And we have a seated warrior position. This one's a little bit harder to describe. Straddle your chair sideways with the back of the chair on your right. Rest your right thigh on the seat. Keep your left foot on the floor. Bend your right knee so it forms a right angle. Keep your left leg straight, left foot on the floor. Inhale, raising both arms parallel to the floor. Hold for 4 to 6 breaths and repeat on the other side. So it looks very dynamic. So you're seated with your right whole thigh on the chair, and your right knee is bent, and then the left leg is stretched to the side and behind you. Another item under Healthy You, love at any age. The secret to successful dating is sensible expectations, says author Francine Russo. When she says that finding love is possible at any age, twice-widowed Francine Russo speaks from experience. You don't have to be young, highly attractive, or rich. You just have to be emotionally ready and willing to work at it, said Russo, 74, who is a journalist focusing on psychology. She has written for Time, The Atlantic, and Scientific American. Her new book, Love After 50, shares her journey, intertwined with anecdotes and research culled from interviews. We caught up with her to learn her insights on finding and keeping love. Question. A year of isolation has many people feeling socially awkward. What can you say to help them? Answer. If you decide you're emotionally ready, then I say get rid of that pandemic hair and those sweatpants. Get a great outfit that makes you feel fabulous. And enjoy the fact that, hey, you're going to have a lot of adrenaline flowing and everything will be new again. Go to restaurants. Be across the table from another human being. You're going to enjoy that, even if this person isn't someone you're going to fall in love with. Just enjoy life unfolding again. Question. So it's not superficial to focus on the hair and the outfit before you get back out there? Answer. No. Because you don't need to be thin or gorgeous or young to be dating, but you do need to feel like your best self. I'm past 70. Sometimes I look in the mirror and say, oh, no. But sometimes I will get a new haircut. I will put on some makeup, and I will wear a great blouse and go out feeling confident. Whatever your best self is, go for it. Question. Do you think that some people, having lived through the isolation of the early pandemic, may experience more joy in dating than they had felt before COVID hit? Answer. I think people will definitely feel this. Many have experienced loneliness through COVID and are missing what a real partner could have given them. They miss companionship and just talking to someone else and seeing another face. And if you get to the point where you hold hands and hug, that's even better. Question. You write that we can widen our dating pool by narrowing our demands, but doesn't that mean we would be compromising? Answer. Suppose that you're with someone who does not check off a whole bunch of the boxes you have. This person does not share your love of travel or baseball, for instance. But suppose this person really gets you and doesn't judge. This person is somebody who actually wants to hear about your day. Is that settling? I don't think so. I think you've found a great relationship. Question. Why do you believe we're more likely to find deep love after 50? Answer. Research has found that older adults are more emotionally stable and more focused on the positive. At this stage of life, you don't have to pick a mate who will be a good parent or who can help you provide financially for your family. Your only consideration is to pick someone with whom you have a truly loving relationship for who you are now. The person you have become. Question, where is the best place to find someone? Answer, I have had stories of accidental meetings on an Uber ride, at church, or a gym. So being out in the world and emotionally open is good. But most people find that online dating gives them the greatest choice of people they wouldn't have met otherwise. Question, how do we figure out which traits we require and those we can live without? Answer. There's a hilarious chapter in the book about two 70-year-old guys. One had a short list and met someone immediately. The other wanted a woman who was attractive, 10 years younger than he was, outdoorsy, cultured, educated. He had a very particular list, and he had no luck. And women do exactly the same thing. Well, he eventually went back to one of the also-rans. She was a little older, and he said, well, she's outdoorsy. And guess what? They're still together. Question, how do you know it's right? Answer, at our age, we often say, Let's be monogamous for a while and see how we work together. I call it trying a relationship. It doesn't take very long, because at our age, you find out very quickly whether this person is right. As one therapist told me, older people get better at catch and release. Question: you say that we have our best sex after 50. How is this possible? Answer: I don't mean movie sex. I mean the most intimate, collaborative sex of your life. You and your partner work together. You tell each other what you can and can't do. It's more intimate and more caring. And finally, what about those of us who are in long-term relationships? How do we continue to keep those growing and exciting? Answer: there's a limited amount of time we have left with our partner. Neither of us is going to change our basic character all that much. We can grow and we can renegotiate, but we need to be forgiving of each other's flaws. You've experienced so much life, maybe divorce, illnesses. You've had losses. You've seen what the big blows are in life. So with any disagreement, any annoying habit, you have to ask yourself, how important is this particular thing compared with the relationship I have? Happy couples tell me over and over, I let it go. Love After 50, published by Simon & Schuster in conjunction with AARP, is available now. Christine Fellingham is a former editor with Glamour and O, the Oprah magazine. And here's a little sidebar article from AARP, The Bulletin: what you can do to help the Earth. Park the car. Reducing by half the number of car trips under a mile could save 2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions per year. Walking more isn't just good for the planet, it's good for your health, says Jonathan Patz, MD, director of the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin. Unplug electricity vampires. Many electronics and appliances, including stereo components, phone chargers, coffee makers, and charging stations for electric toothbrushes, draw power even when turned off. These always-on devices eat up 23% of U.S. home power, says the Natural Resources Defense Council. Unplug what you aren't using. For TVs and computers, use a power strip with an on-off switch. Well, folks, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.